This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's no stretch to say solar power is booming in Massachusetts. There's been an 80-fold increase in the past 6 years. In May, the Patrick's administration announced that Massachusetts had reached its 2017 goal for installed solar power 4 years early. They then proceeded to raise the goal to 1,600 megawatts installed by 2020. Given the controversy that has surrounded both offshore and land-based wind energy development in recent years, solar power can seem like a panacea for homeowners and towns looking to reduce their electricity bills and cut their carbon footprint. But everything has its pros and cons. Solar power is no exception. Manufacturing solar panels comes with environmental impacts, and if they're not being installed on a roof, there can be tough land use decisions to be made. So today we're talking about the realities and complexities of solar power, both good and bad. My guests are Megan Amsler, Executive Director of Cape and Islands Self-Reliance and Co-Chair of the Falmouth Energy Committee. She's also Treasurer of the Cape and Islands Renewable Energy Collaborative and the Falmouth Alternative Representative to the Cape Light Compact. Amsler established Cape Cod as a Million Solar Roofs partner and has facilitated over 500 installations in the region. Also, Michael Stone, Policy and Regulations Manager for My Generation Energy, a solar installer based in South Dennis. He has experience in renewable energy policy, strategy, and finance, and has conducted research on Massachusetts' Green Communities Act. And last but not least, Paul Gasek, an independent writer and producer living in Brewster. Previously, he's been the senior science editor for Discovery Channel and the executive producer of Deadliest Catch. And his documentary series, The Tipping Points, about climate change is currently airing on The Weather Channel. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And of course, we want to hear from you. Get ready to share your solar power success stories. Tell us your woes or get your questions answered. We'll open the phones a little later this hour. Let's start first. Where do we stand with installed capacity in Massachusetts? Megan Amsler, give us a sense, thousands of megawatts, hundreds of megawatts? I mean, we've seen this 80-fold increase, but when you're starting from zero, that doesn't necessarily mean a lot, right?
You know, if you go on to the Clean Energy Center, the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, they have an interactive site where you can look and see town by town the growth over the years, which I think is kind of neat. So, back in 2002 was really when the Renewable Energy Trust Fund began distributing incentives to people who wanted to put up solar on their rooftops. And so that number has definitely grown. And here in this region, we've seen a tremendous increase of solar installations. And I mean, that's solar.
Falmouth, you're saying, has the second most installations of any town in the state.
Yes. We're second to Boston. So I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of residential PV and more businesses are starting to embrace the technology and looking at their roof space and saying, we've got a potential asset here. And I would say the policy has definitely, that's been something that has changed. As you just indicated, the Patrick administration has been very supportive of, you know, sort of raising the bar for the solar capacity goals. And we have seen great growth because of the incentives, the SRECs and the solar renewable energy certificates. Uh-huh. So that is for every kilowatt hour that is generated from a PV system, whether you use it on site or sell it back to the grid, you have a it's like a
production incentive.
It's exactly. It's a tradable commodity, basically. We have the renewable portfolio standard here in Massachusetts. Not every state has a renewable portfolio standard, but that is basically driving utilities to have to supply a certain percentage of their electricity that is sold and consumed in this state to be produced from renewable energy.
So is most of this growth happening in the residential sector? Is this mostly people putting panels on their roofs? Or how does it break down between, you know, residential businesses trying to generate their own power and then actual utilities trying to generate solar power?
I think it's pretty broad-based. Yeah. If you look at the composition of installations, about 80% is on the commercial side as far as the total volume.
Right.
But as far as the number of installations, about 80% is on the residential side.
So there are a lot of homeowners that are putting panels
exactly.
on the roofs, but obviously
there's
a few
smaller panels.
Right, those
right.
are small
right.
installations.
Right.
And then we've got a few utilities that are
right.
putting up much larger.
Yeah,
100 kilowatt, you know, you get if you have the capacity for your building and the roof is engineered well, you can put up, you know, 100 kilowatts, 80 kilowatts. And we're starting to see that because
so In terms of what that means and how much energy. So 100 kilowatts, is that enough power for your whole house? Are most of these solar panels powering someone's entire home load and taking them off the grid? Or is this just a little supplement?
Well, I think one thing that we should absolutely be clear about is most people stay on the grid. So I have a grid-tied system. We use the grid as a battery, in essence. And because I don't have batteries in my basement. But every, you know, I hear this question often. People want to know, well, you know, what size system do I need? Well, it really depends on how much electricity you use. And I teach renewable energy sources at the Cape Cod Community College. And every semester we go through this. And it's, I have, you know, kids that are fresh out of high school and older adults that are coming into the classroom. And a fair number of them don't know how to read an electricity bill. And that to me is terrifying, because you can't, you know, from a more esoteric perspective, you can't manage what you haven't measured. And how, you know, people just, we pay our bills electronically now, so we really don't even see the money going out, or, you know, wow, I have no idea how much I'm paying for electricity. Mm-hmm. So it really does depend. And the utility bill has this nice little 13-month snapshot that tells you, you know, what you're using kilowatt hour wise per month. And that tells us a lot about people's consumption. Like, wow, what's going on here in February? And I'm using, you know, I have three people in the house and I'm using 900 kilowatt hours. Because on average in Massachusetts and New England, family of four supposedly uses about between 500 and 600 kilowatt hours per month.
Now, in I know farther south in the country, the largest electricity usage is
AC.
In the summer for air conditioning. Yep. Are we kind of flipped here in Massachusetts, where most of our electricity usage is during the winter for lighting during these dark days, or
no,
for heating?
We start to see, I mean, when I look at people's electricity bills, I too see spikes now in the summertime. We didn't used to have huge spikes in electricity consumption in the summer. It was maybe some dehumidification, but now so many places are putting in AC because our climate is changing.
St. Paul Basic, is that a climate impact, or is that a change in people's tolerance for heat? Are we to the point where we are seeing, you know, we're seeing more heat waves nationwide? Do you think we're seeing that impact locally?
Oh, I think that's true. I mean, I think statistically that's true. And so the summers, some of the hottest summers that we've ever had on record have been in the last 7 to 8 years. So I think certainly it's true. I mean, and also we're aging. So some of us older people are less tolerant of the heat. Right. And so we need we need a cooler environment. And I think just I see this a lot where people come to the Cape from air conditioning in cities, and we rent our house, and they insist on air conditioners. So we until last summer we had never put an air conditioner in our old house, but we decided to rent it and raise some money. And so I think the upshot is that we're definitely seeing impacts. I think a lot of people think that the effects of climate change are happening somewhere else, but actually those effects are happening here as well.
And I think one of the key things with solar as well is it produces energy exactly when you have those peak times.
Exactly.
So it offsets kind of the times when you have to bring on the least efficient power plants, like the coal power plants, the oil power plants. And actually, we saw in the last summer as well, even affecting nuclear power plants as well. So Pilgrim Power Plant in Plymouth had to go down for many days because the heat was too high, because they cooled the plant. And that's, you know, something about solar that a lot of people don't think about is there's no water use as well. So that's a huge advantage for solar, especially, you know, when you're producing during the summer, covering the energy usage on
and
those
hot
days.
And it's on-site.
Exactly.
You're providing that
locally.
You know, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, so when we're talking about these trends and how much is installed and kilowatt hours, that's entirely the, as you were saying, Megan, the PV, photovoltaic, so producing electricity. But solar can be used to heat hot water as well. That doesn't count into any of these statistics and trends, right, the solar hot water systems?
Well, I would just back up. The PV has gotten really cheap over the past couple of years. We recommend that people don't use electricity to heat water. There are solar hot water systems, which are, you know, sort of old school, pretty basic systems. I have a huge system at my house, and with a 1,500 gallon tank in the basement, turn the boiler off for 6 months of the year, and that's fabulous. But a lot of people don't want to do that. They want some little appliance, and we're seeing a lot more installations of heat pumps and that sort of thing for hot water. And that technology has come up. So people switching from, say, an electric resistance hot water heater and moving over to an air heat pump type installation. Right. And you can do that quite nicely with a PV system. So, and I think we're, you know, some of the installers that I've, you know, that I talk with on a regular basis, I keep asking, so how about those EV charger people? You know, are people starting to add some capacity to their arrays or look at building a bigger array in anticipation of having an electric vehicle that they would like to be charging? And I'm starting to hear some of that stuff. So that's, to me, that's heartening.
So we're starting to see the technology branch out into different areas as opposed to just
consumers are starting to really think about, okay, if I'm going to reduce my fossil fuel consumption, what are the ways that I can do this? And frankly, we don't have the infrastructure around here for hydrogen and we have the grid for electricity and EVs, they're on the streets. People are driving that. I think in Woods Hole, there's a fair number of them driving around. And so this is something that people can say, wow, I have the opportunity now to purchase an electric vehicle and could actually generate the fuel for that from the sun. So I think people are starting to make those connections.
Yeah, and I think electric vehicles is like one of the only industries that's growing faster than PV as well. So it's amazing how that's happening at the same time, but probably no coincidence. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're definitely seeing, as you said, solar booming here in Massachusetts. But I think on a national level, a lot of the conversation has been dominated by Solyndra, this, you know, one company that failed. This is an indicator of a floundering solar industry. How different is what's going on here in Massachusetts? How different is that from what's going on nationwide?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, we definitely see Massachusetts as maybe kind of like the progressive capital of the world in a sense. But, you know, you look at the growth in solar in other states as well, states like Arizona, North Carolina, Georgia has just announced a large solar program. I think Solyndra is a good example, too, and it's, you know, commonly used in the sense of, okay, here's a company that failed, but if you kind of take a step back and look at the broader picture and say, well, why did it fail? Because many other manufacturers are more competitive, so it means the costs are coming down, so it's very positive for consumers. So I think it's kind of, you know, one of those things that people focus on, but if you take a step back and look at the broader industry, it's really a positive sign because there are more manufacturers that can produce at a lower cost than Solyndra could. So it's very positive.
And Megan, you mentioned that the cost of solar has come way down in recent years. Is that just a factor of competition in the market, or have there been changes in the technology that have also made it cheaper?
Yeah, the technology has not changed much at all. And I always find it very interesting when people are like, well, I think I'm going to wait to do a solar installation. I'm going to wait for the technology to get a little more advanced. And I'm like, don't bother, because from a climate context, we don't have the time to wait around for this. In this region, PV systems are about 15% efficiency, so that's not bad. I mean, I have a
they're actually that 15%. They're taking in 15% of the sunlight.
It's basically that the rated capacity of the system because the sun goes down, right? So your system is not producing power 24 hours a day. And we all know what's going on outside right now. You know, today is...
it's not a great day for solar power today.
And this time of the year is actually wretched, right? So I would say in the summer months, I have sun on my array from 7:30 in the morning until about 7 at night. So, and we have net metering in the state. So basically, when you have production on site for more than you are consuming, you're spinning that meter backwards. So I haven't paid an electric bill since my system went online. So about 5 years, which is great because that's what I wanted was to have that ability to generate the electricity. But, you know, the costs have come down because China's playing in the marketplace, frankly.
I mean, they're really, you know, increasing scale. I think the growth of the industry is just in itself is driving down costs. And I think to Megan's point, as far as, you know, consumers considering installing a system as well, costs are coming down. But at the same time, you know, policymakers want to bring incentives down as well. So I think now is, you know, just as attractive a time as any to go solar, for sure.
When was the last time anybody bought an appliance? Because that's what I see PV as. That pays them back in 3.5 years. I mean, you're done paying for it. And then it's guaranteed to be producing power for the next 20 years, and it's got no moving parts, right? We can't say that about most of our appliances, especially in today's planned obsolescence.
But what you all are talking about, though, is solar power in service to individuals.
Yes.
And individuals are not the only groups who are trying to install solar arrays and that sort of thing. I come from a town of Brewster, and the town's decided that they want to put in a big solar array, but they're going to cut down an old forest to do it. And so, you know, I think the nuts and bolts of costs are very important. I mean, the market has to be able to support it. So costs coming down are good. But from my point of view, I think about the two big promises that solar energy makes or made. And one was that it would generate electricity with no CO2 emissions. Mm-hmm. And two, that it would do it in a way that didn't damage the environment. I mean, we think about coal, oil, and gas over the years. Right. It's been a long history of environmental degradation. So to cut down a forest to put up a solar array, it breaks both of those promises.
Absolutely.
So, what was that?
That never sounded like some weather.
They're firing in the hills. So I think that along with bringing down prices and improving systems and efficiencies, that also people need to understand more what solar is, what the trade-offs are, and how it dovetails with natural systems.
We're talking this hour about solar power, current trends, and both the potential benefits and shortcomings of the technology. I'm joined by Megan Amsler, Executive Director of Cape and Island Self-Reliance, Michael Stone, Policy and Regulations Manager at My Generation Energy, and independent writer and producer Paul Gasek. We also invite you to join our conversation. Share your solar power success stories, air your discontent, or get your questions answered. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free phone number. Don't forget to press 5 when you call to get the studio. You can also reach us by email at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about whether or not the technology of solar power, how much that has changed in recent years. And Paul Gasek, you were saying earlier this morning before we went on something about the fact that in fact, the technology has changed a bit in terms of the efficiency, that it wasn't until just a few years ago that solar power had the ability to completely break even in terms of the carbon footprint of manufacturing, the energy that goes into the manufacturing of them versus the energy that they were able to generate after installation.
Yeah, I think that just to back up for a little bit, I think that a lot of people think that if you just put up a solar array and turn it on, that you start to gain ground on the CO2 or the carbon dioxide problem, and that's not true. There's a lot of energy used in the production of solar panels, and it wasn't until about 2010 or so that the solar industry began
It's not individual panels or the technology.
No. This is the aggregate number. You know, and all of the panels began to produce more electricity than was consumed in their manufacture.
And so that's in part a factor of this growth of the industry. Yes. That the more installations you get, the more economies of scale you get for the whole industry.
That's true enough. And there are some small improvements in efficiency.
And those mostly come from inverters.
Okay. So I'm learning a lot here today too.
there are some interesting. There have been some interesting technological developments, and one that I find intriguing is the idea of, instead of putting up these large panels on your roof, that there are actually now available on the market photovoltaic shingles that you could just shingle your whole roof. And Megan, you're making a horrible face here.
It's thin film technology, and it's that's a prime example of how efficiency has just not changed at all. You know, 3 to 5% efficient is where that technology's at. And, you know, solar's not
less.
Fabulous. It's not in terms of a technology and how much energy you can get out of it. It's conservation and efficiency. That's my soapbox, right? We want to make sure that you're reducing the amount of energy that you're consuming in general, making sure that you're making smart decisions and turning appliances off and that kind of stuff to drive down the load. But those shingles, they just, they're not there yet.
Yeah. Well, it seems like also we're learning a lot about solar. We're still kind of in the learning phase. There was a study that came out a few weeks ago showing, you know, I think there's been this dogma around that we were too far north for solar to even work. And clearly that's not the case. Germany has installed a lot of solar and built a lot of their energy grid around that. And they're even more light limited than we are. But then there was this interesting study that came out a few weeks ago saying, well, this idea that your solar panels have to face due south is not necessarily right, that in fact, westward facing solar panels can be even more efficient than south facing.
Well, and that depends on where you are and your declination and all, you know, the longitude and latitude of every place. And I would say, you know, to Paul's point about solar, there are true costs about that. And Michael, you can certainly speak about, you know, the types of installations mm-hmm. that my generation does, because they use microinverters, and that enables you, you know, the rule of thumb is you need a good solar window between 9 and 3. And there's this cool little nifty tool that we put up on the rooftop that says, you know, here's what your solar capacity is going to be throughout the year, what the shading issues are, which if you took to the forest, it would tell you right there, bad place.
Bad place.
And just to go back to that, because I had read something that indicated that was even sort of in the shadow of the hill, that site.
Well, so you're talking now about the Brewster project.
Yeah, larger.
It's funny. The place has been zoned industrial, so it's sort of like a dead forest standing at this point. But it's beautiful. If you walk up there, it's a 80-year-old forest. There are big oak trees and pines. It's a knob and kettle. There's at least one vernal pool. It's sort of up and down. It's a beautiful thing. So in order to actually turn this place into a place for a solar array, they've got to take out all the trees. They've got to grade the whole thing so that it can receive those concrete stands. And so the whole thing is just going to be a big CO2 release.
Those trees are usually sucking carbon dioxide
out
of the atmosphere.
Yes,
so you've got a carbon dioxide cost.
It's a carbon sink. So you cut it down and all of that carbon is slowly released back into the atmosphere. There's going to be a lot of fuel and electricity used to cut down the forest and grade it. And then you also have to figure in all of the CO2 that the forest would have absorbed, won't anymore. And so solar already comes with a carbon debt. By cutting down the forest, you increase the carbon debt at a time when we should be decreasing carbon debts. And so the two systems are complementary. On the front end, you've got the solar panels producing emissions-free, CO2-free electricity. On the back end, you've got trees taking it out of the atmosphere. But cut down the trees and you've got a win-lose situation. And I think we should be going for win-win across the board. Leave the forest intact and find sand pits. Break it up a little bit. You guys are talking about individual rooftops. I mean, a 1,000 or 100,000 rooftops on Cape Cod would be a power plant.
So, Megan Amsler, is a rooftop the ideal? I mean, it's already flat. It's probably less shaded. Is the rooftop the ideal place to put solar?
I would say that's, you know, again, we want to make sure that we have good access, because there are ways that you can do it if your ridge line is running north-south. And, you know, take a drive around and you'll see people have their, you know, the subdivisions are not made with solar access in mind.
Frankly. Right. I mean, my house is a 1955 house and we run exactly north-south.
Right. So you could do something, maybe an awning mount over your porch or something along those lines. And we encourage people to think outside the box when it comes to this kind of stuff. If you have a garage, or you could do a parking canopy, whatever. But yes, I would say that people need to think about this. And just to Paul's point, I totally agree with you. The true costs of doing installations like this are always on my mind. But I don't want to dissuade people from taking the initiative to do this, because we take for granted when we turn the lights on, we don't really think about where that energy is coming from and all of the true costs associated with that. You know, right. Same thing when we start up our car. We just don't think about that. And I don't want to have people get off the hook that easily. I feel like we need to take this stuff really seriously. We need to do everything we possibly can as individuals. We all consume it, right? We have a responsibility, a social responsibility, an environmental responsibility to make this, to address this issue of climate change. And
So Paul, your argument is we shouldn't be just exchanging one set of environmental costs for another set.
Absolutely.
I think that's right. I mean, liquidating ecological assets to raise money for the government. I mean, what does that sound like? It's like every country in Central America And all and any other country that's deforested, I mean, it's deforestation.
Right.
So whether it's in the Amazon or in Brewster, it amounts to the same thing. And I think at a time when we're really concerned about CO2, we're really concerned about the effects of climate change, we have to do everything we can to max out these systems. That means leaving the trees alone and letting them suck up the CO2 and putting the solar arrays in place and letting them deny and let them deny the atmosphere, the CO2. And together, we might actually make inroads. But if we're shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit as we do this, that's just not a good idea.
Yeah, and I think the state through the Department of Energy Resources, they're trying to kind of dissuade some of that deforestation through the regulatory process to try to, you know, focus installations on rooftops where they're most valuable, right where the energy is being used. So I think that's kind of where the state is going. And for homeowners and businesses that are exploring solar, it's very easy to get an assessment and see what the feasibility of your location is as well.
All right. If you have a solar success story or a question you'd like answered, our phone number is 866-999-4626. Press 5 when you call. Greg calls us from Oak Bluffs. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're doing great.
I've got a two-part question. The first part is, my electric bill has like a $70 like hookup fee. Like even if I didn't use electricity, I'd be paying that a month. So I'm wondering what happens to that. And also, like what happens to your roof when you need to do roof work after the solar panels are put on it?
Two good questions, Greg. Let's see if we can get some answers here.
Can quickly answer the roof question. You know, one of the things that when they come out to do a site evaluation is they look at the integrity of the roof right off the bat and sort of make a judgment call there of like, do we need to redo the roof or is it going to be okay? You know, do you have 15 years left on this roof? Do you have 20 years left on the roof? And remember that once you have an installation, that installation is protecting the roof, so it is no longer being damaged by UV and all of that other fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's. Do you have a metal roof, or is it?
No, it's a regular shingle roof.
Okay,
but I'm worrying about because basically half my bill is just a hookup fee.
Is this for a residential or for a commercial installation?
Yeah, on the vineyard. No, this is residential on the vineyard. So it's like, even if I didn't use anything, I'd be paying like $70-$80 by the time like fees are all kind of factored out.
That doesn't sound right to me.
Wow. Yeah.
No, it doesn't sound
usually
right.
There's typically a customer charge.
It's like $3.73.
But yeah, definitely double check your rate. NSTAR has their rates online. You know, we can certainly review your electric bill as well if you'd like. But yeah, that sounds unusually high.
All right. Well, good questions. Thanks for giving us a call, Greg. And I hope you can figure out that issue with your electricity bill. We've got another question here. Can solar arrays be installed within the various historic districts in our region? And I know that's a contentious issue in some communities.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of discussion about that. We've worked with a number of historic districts, and it's gone quite smoothly. I think, you know, you want to integrate it into the roof and into the building as seamlessly as possible. And that's kind of the nice thing about solar with permitting is it's a lot easier to permit a solar installation versus other energy sources. You know, we've seen with larger power plants or pipelines, you know, there are none of those problems associated with solar.
And that's essentially what we're saying. There's not really environmental impacts or health impacts or whatever once they're installed, so they're easier
right.
to
and
get
a lot
sighted.
Of the commercial solar installations on the Cape, a lot of people have never even seen. So the majority of the capacity that's been installed, most people can't actually see. Which
now, is that because they're on rooftops that people don't see or because they're hidden away in other places?
A lot of the installations are being done on commercial real estate or retailers, a lot of those larger kind of big box
right,
locations.
Big flat roofs.
Exactly. And so it's a good thing in a sense, but it's also kind of a drawback where you're not kind of getting the technology out there. I mean, you can see a lot of homeowners and installations on the street just driving around, and that's becoming more common, and people are more familiar with the technology as well.
Now, talk a little bit, one of the other increasing trends, obviously we've talked a little bit about the project in Brewster. We're going to talk with Wellfleet here in a moment, but this idea of a community solar garden, more towns are getting into the idea mm-hmm. of trying to generate their own solar power, and community solar gardens, I guess, are kind of a hot trend. So what exactly is that?
Yeah, so we worked closely with the town of Brewster to get in place the Brewster Community Solar Garden. And here in Massachusetts, you can actually generate power at one location, and that power generates a credit on the bill, and you can send that to other accounts. So that system in Brewster actually generates a credit that could be sent to around 40 different accounts within Brewster. So we have the liquor store, we have one of the churches in Brewster, we have a whole array of homeowners as well.
And so those people have what, paid in up front to be part of this?
Right. So they're purchasing electricity from a solar installation that's nearby in their community at a, you know, basically a fixed price, effectively.
Now, that's not using a separate infrastructure, a separate grid, right? This is a virtual thing. That's
exactly.
That solar,
there's only
those
one
solar,
grid.
Right. The solar panels are just all paying into the same system, and then that's just coming back in the sense
in
that
the
you're buying
credit.
Power from
it's
it.
It's all utility accounting, effectively.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, we've got more folks on the line here. Carol is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Carol, are you on the air here?
Hello? You there?
We're here, Carol. We're having a little technical issue, but we're back.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if anyone's considered, chances are they have, of using the existing power lines to put in solar arrays.
You know, it's funny. That just came up. Paul, you were saying that.
There's just one grid.
Well, no, no, you were saying the power corridors as a possible thing for installing solar.
Well, you know, I was driving down here this morning in the car, talking to myself like a madman in the car, just trying to sort things out. And I just suddenly occurred to me, like, one of the biggest open spaces on Cape Cod is the NSTAR power corridor. So why not actually put a big solar, just run solar panels up the middle of that thing from one end to the other, and we have this enormous power plant. And then we don't have to cut down any forests. And not only that, it would hold down the brush underneath it. NSTAR wouldn't need to spray herbicides. So it's kind of a win-win-win-win.
You have to wonder why that hasn't been thought of and why there aren't. Is there a downside that we can think of?
I'm guessing probably the state has thought about it on some level. I think, you know, some things with shading, there might be impacts there. I think they have looked in a similar approach, looked at medians. For highways and things of that nature.
Well, of course, there's parking lots are another.
Parking lots.
We don't have a lot of free space here on the Cape. We do have parking lots.
Landfills. No, Brewster is starting a big array on its Cap landfill. I'm all for that. And we have sand pits. I'm all, you know, let's use the sand pits. Let's use brownfields. Let's use those places. You know, the reason you see big solar arrays in the desert is because it's a really good place for them. But if you want to bring solar arrays like that east into the woodlands, you have to create kind of a desert, which means you've got to have an open space. And if you don't use existing open space, you have to create one. And that's kind of what they're proposing in Brewster. But I think the interesting thing is that with a solar array, you can actually break it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And put 5 acres here and 4 acres here. And we have plenty of sand pits. So my point is, if you don't have to cut down a forest to put up a solar array, why would you?
This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are Michael Stone, Policy and Regulations Manager at My Generation Energy, independent writer and producer Paul Gasek, and Megan Amsler, Executive Director of Cape and Island Self-Reliance. We're talking about solar power, good, bad, and ugly. We also hope you'll join us, share your solar power success stories, air your discontent, or get your questions answered. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Press 5 to reach the studio. And you can also reach us, of course, by email at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We're also joined now by Marcus Springer of the Wellfleet Energy Committee and one of the spearheaders of the town's participation in Solarize Massachusetts. Marcus Springer, welcome.
Hello, yes, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good. I'm glad you could make the time for us. Now, Marcus, how much solar is already installed in Wellfleet, and how much of that is residential versus commercial?
I don't know the exact number off by heart, but we do have a number of installations on town buildings, like the fire station and the library. And there's probably, I would say, 27 to, you know, somewhere between 25 and 30 installations on residential. So it's largely residential installations at this point.
All right. So why join Solarize Massachusetts, this state program?
So what we're trying to do is to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by the creation of as much renewable energy as possible. So the Solarize Massachusetts program offers a very good structure for communities in the Commonwealth to do that. and it offers a tiered pricing program, which if you hit the highest tier, you can have installations for considerably less than, let's say, the going market rate. So it's a financial strategy as well as a kind of bulk purchase strategy to encourage as many installations as possible.
So what's involved in the program from the town's side of things? And are there any potential, I don't know, downsides or benefits? Why you know, Wellfleet's only the second town on the Cape to join the program. So is there something that might be holding towns back?
Well, perhaps. There is, we always think Wellfleet is it's a very unique place. And I think if, you know, they could secede from the union, they probably would. But there's quite a few interesting characters there. But we have, I think the Solarize program is now in its, I believe, third year. So they take on eight new communities every year. So we were one of the eight this time, and I know there are 15 because some grouped together to be one community, as it were. So it is a competitive RFP process, and I think a lot of it might be fear of change, things like that. I mean, that's the largest thing I see as an obstacle in a lot of this renewable energy discussion in different towns. However, Wellfleet has embraced it, and I think we're all very excited about this. And the process is you have a core team, as it were, to roll it out. And we've, in our strategy, we took on partners like the Mass Autobahn Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary and the Churn Foundation, which is a foundation based on the Cape that funds solar installations, and they have given us a generous grant to pay for some core team members, so we actually have paid staff. The town is a member of the team as well, and we have a so-called solar coach who really kind of leads the team, and that is a member of our energy committee.
All right. Well, Marcus Springer, thanks for bringing us up to date on Wellfleet's participation in Solarize Massachusetts. Megan Amsler, I wonder, as you know, there are all these new projects and incentives, especially here in Massachusetts, to spread solar. As we begin to scale up, do we reach any sort of limits or boundaries with the grid technology that we have now? Or, you know, are there any problem? You know, do we need a smarter grid? Do we need a different kind of metering system in order to be able to handle this very distributed energy generation that's also very, you know, variable, fluctuating with the weather? Do we hit a limiting point with the technology we currently have in place?
That's a good point. And I would say that, you know, right now, the question about our grid is kind of held together with bubblegum and duct tape. So when we get a big storm, we see that there are flaws in the system. But overall, it's doing its job, and electrons are electrons. And I've read a number of studies talking about the level of penetration for renewable energy on our grid, and that we can see, 20%, it can handle a 20%, the amount of power coming in from renewable resources could be up to 20%. And that's through ISO New England.
So even if we totally scaled up solar, we're not looking at blowing through that 20% coming from renewable.
And your question about the smart grid, do we need smart grid? Absolutely. Do we need to? I think that technology is, we're seeing some pilots. I know they did a pilot for that out on Martha's Vineyard. And some really cool things happening, like on the Falkland Islands, where they're doing, but that's looking at electric vehicles and all different kinds of renewable energy. And you look in Samsø Island in Denmark, they're really moving forward on this stuff, but islands. And we're geographically defined by water here as well. Do we have a lot of work to do on the efficiency and the conservation side of things? Absolutely. So that when we do have the temperature spikes in the summertime and people are cranking up the air conditioners, you need to have your house insulated and air sealed. You wouldn't buy a refrigerator with a leaky gasket, so I think that
you gotta do the conservation
absolutely.
Work first.
It's free, That's I just want to make a plug here for the Cape Light Compact's energy efficiency program, because that, to me, people are just not, they get attracted to the sort of the sexy part of solar. And then they realize, like, wow, I'm really using a lot of electricity here.
Right.
And that there is a way to tackle this. And it's through the Cape Light Compact. Free air sealing.
The home energy audits, yep. And the insulation.
Yep,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah, great program. Marcus Springer, you had something you wanted to add.
I mean, I echo what Megan says about the CLC, and you really have to have a good sealed envelope to take advantage of renewable power. But I think just one more thing about Wellfleet is, and also I think one of the earlier people mentioned large-scale solar arrays on capped landfills. So we're also doing that in Wellfleet. We'll be putting a 400-kilowatt system on our landfill, which will power up to 80% of the town building's needs. And also for our solarized program, we have created a solar map of the town. And that is being done by a company called Mapdwell, who started in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They did that city first, and they've since done Washington, D.C., and have now have a large contract for the state of Oregon. But what the solar map does is it creates a website so individuals and business owners can log on and see their home or business and understand how much solar power they can generate, like what is the optimal position for panels on the roof, and understand return on investment, different leasing structures or outright purchase structures, and time scale for that return.
So a great tool with a lot of information for folks.
Using LIDAR surveying. So what that is light laser surveys. So you can see the pitch of the roofs and all shade structures like trees and anything like that. They've developed a software that tracks that every hour of every day for a year.
Hmm.
And it's a fascinating program, and it's kind of unique in terms of solar maps. So ours will be rolled out mid-January in time for the beginning of the Solarize application process in February.
Sounds like a fascinating tool.
So we're trying to use that as a, hopefully that will be a model going forward for towns and to have a solar map as well.
Yeah. All right. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Press 5 to reach the studio. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster.
Well, you were asking about past experiences. I had been using a solar panel for 20 years now. It was found by a couple of little kids up in the head of a marsh down in Wellfleet, and they couldn't get it to work, and so they gave it to me, and I've been using it ever since.
Joel, it sounds like a very resilient panel there. What, Michael Stone, what is the average lifespan of a solar panel?
Yeah, so typical systems are made to last 25 to 30 years. Most panels are warrantied. I mean, the industry standard is really 25 years. Many of the other components in the system are 10 or 15 years warrantied too. So it's really built to be there on your roof for a significant amount of time.
Well, and we were talking earlier about some of the manufacturing costs, mm-hmm. the carbon debt that comes with these. How long does it take to pay off the carbon debt of a solar panel?
Right. So that's a good question. So the National Renewable Energy Laboratory did a study recently where the energy payback from when it was manufactured to the system being on your home, it only takes about 1 to 4 years, depending on the type of the system. Also, another component of that is that more systems are being installed outside of Germany as well, because you know, you want to be in a good location for solar. Massachusetts is a lot better than Germany. And Germany, for a very long time, had the most solar. I think they're still one of the leaders. But more systems are being installed in better locations for solar as well. So that reduces the energy payback.
Yeah. Paul Gaser.
I think the economics of this thing are really important. It has to work for individuals. It has to, I mean, that's the only way that, you know, the greatest impact on the problem of CO2 is going to be from the greatest number of people who buy into it and do something. But I think if it becomes only about the money, then the energy produced becomes just other energy. So alternative energy is about making energy in a different way and doing it in a different way. And if we forget that it's about CO2, it's the, you know, if there was no carbon problem, why wouldn't we just stick with oil and coal? It's the infrastructure's in place. It's relatively inexpensive. Solar's, you know, we're waiting for the price to come down even a little bit more, but it's a CO2 problem, and it's also about no more spills. It's about no more decapitated mountains. It's about not wrecking aquifers. So I think it's a balance. It's the economics, but it's also the reason we do these things and the relative values of ecological assets and this kind of energy.
Well, yeah. So we've talked about the carbon footprint that goes into manufacturing these, but what about the materials that go into making a solar panel? I mean, there are rare earth metals that have to be mined. There have been reports coming out saying we're looking at limitations in how much rare earth metal we can actually pull out of the earth. This goes into all of our electronic gadgets that we love now. So what about the non-carbon footprint of solar mm-hmm. panels?
Yep. So the Department of Energy has done some research on this, the rare earth metals. Those are most relevant to things like wind turbines, things that use a lot of magnets, because those require a lot of rare earth metals. Also, thin film solar panels use tellurium, and that's a rare earth metal. And the good thing about kind of the regular crystalline solar panels is that one of the main inputs is polysilicon. And silicon, most people know, is, you know, they associate with sand effectively. so, it, you know, it's very common, one of the most common elements, you know, here on the planet. So I think we're seeing costs come down. Some have said that manufacturing solar panels is very similar to manufacturing, you know, like drywall, basically. The cost is coming down so dramatically. It's so easy to manufacture. So I think, you know, certainly certain materials are important, but I think kind of when you look at the overall picture of the different components that go into a panel, those costs are coming down.
Yeah. Now, in terms of, you know, again, if we were to scale up the limitations that we have in really trying to spread solar, what about batteries? Are we making any progress on batteries so that we can store some of this power for when we need it off peak?
Well, and I would say the answer to that is you still have folks who will invest in the smaller residential battery systems. Not a lot of them. You know, when I talk to people about this, you know, sometimes people will get really excited. We want to go off the grid. I'm like, no, you don't.
Right.
Because the traditional rule of thumb is it's between $8,000 and $10,000 for just the battery bank. And you've got to water it and make sure that it's cool and in a well-ventilated.
There's a lot of maintenance.
Yeah,
it.
it's a headache. And
so the good news is you don't need a
battery. You don't need a battery. We use right. the grid as right. the battery. You know, yep.
But that, of course, means that we still have these other fossil fuel
sure.
power plants that are
absolutely.
Online as backup.
Yep. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I would say on the residential side of things, we're not seeing batteries. You know, people are just not like, woohoo, we're going to go and invest in this. You know, we're just going to do a straight grid-tied system. Where we are seeing the battery technology change is in larger installations. And there's all kinds of interesting cutting-edge technology that are there. You know, it's not a traditional deep cycle battery kind of thing that we would the normal person would think, oh, battery, really inefficient. So, you know, some of that technology is being piloted. I have read about different bases where
so
they're implemented.
We're making some progress.
We are making some progress, yes.
All right. Megan Amsler, Michael Stone, Paul Gasek, thank you all. And thanks to Marcus Springer, from Wellfleet, who made time for us this morning. We hope you'll continue sharing your solar power stories and questions on our website, capeandislands.org. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.